Peter Sutherland, welcome to a very special edition of the Fox Football Podcast this week. Simon Hill, we're on location. And normally
we've gone on tour, guys.
Yeah, normally when someone says they're on location, you imagine them sitting on a, I don't know, a beach in the Maldives or something like that, looking over some clear blue ocean. Not quite the case here. We're in Sydney's west, but for us this is the Maldives because we're inside Camp Socceroo ahead of the game against Lebanon. I'm very excited to chat with our special guest today.
We are. We're in the inner sanctum, and our special guest today is Graeme Arnold's new assistant, or one of Graeme Arnold's new assistants. And he comes with a very impressive CV, of course, having been at Manchester United as Alex Ferguson's number two, and one or two other places besides. He was manager at Fulham. You can introduce him, Garvey.
12 years at Manchester United. I guess that's where people remember you from the most, and it's great to have you as part of our national team right now. Rene Meulensteen, welcome to the Fox Football Podcast.
Delighted to be here.
Great to have you with us. How are you finding it? A couple of games in now, you seem like you're well and truly entrenched. You know Arnie well. How are you finding this new career path for you?
I love it. Right from the start, when Arnie rang me, and I think back in January at that time, it was just something that came my way exactly at the right time. I didn't have to think long at all. When Arnie said, I'm going to take the national team, would you like to go and do it with me? So the first impressions were obviously in the camp that we had back in September, where we didn't have a game. I laid out sort of the guidelines of the way the environment we want to create, so for the players to buy into that, explaining the guidelines how we want to play, for the players to buy into that as well, and doing a lot of stuff on the training pitch. Carry that on in Dubai, in Kuwait, with a game in Kuwait, and now this one here in us, and it's been very good so far, really, really good.
To state the obvious, Rene, you are Dutch, obviously. We've had a long association with Dutch coaches, Pim Verbeek, Huus Hiddink, Rob Baan, of course, was technical director, Han Berger was technical director. What is it about the Netherlands and Australia that's just seemed to suit each other?
Yeah, I think the way that the Dutch in general look at how the game is to be played, you know, in terms of try to dominate possession, but at the same time be expensive in forward play, you know, be creative. You know, Holland is obviously going through a little bit of a difficult patch at the moment, but obviously trying to get back into better times, so to speak, with Ronald Koeman. But I think over the past and over the years, I think those two have matched up really, really well, served each other really well. So I hope that I can bring the same or even more to Australian football. And that's my intent.
I guess the Dutch connection is where you first got to know Graeme Arnold, and that's how you developed a pretty strong connection. Can you talk us through your relationship with Arnie and how far you go back and just why you've managed to click in a football sense?
Yeah, I knew, obviously, Arnie when he played his football in Holland for Roda JC and NAC Breda, so that's where I knew him from. Striker, scoring a lot of goals, you know, ruffled some feather in his times. And then I think 10, 12 years ago, he came to Manchester United for his foreign club visit as part of his pro license, which we had quite a few of. Normally they come in pairs or threes or fours, but Arnie came by himself. And so Alex was always very good to palm them off to me. Can you look after them, you know? So I did with Arnie. So we spent a lot of time together. You know, it was a week or 10 days, I think, he was with us. So he was at every training session. We discussed tactics. We discussed what it was like to work with top players, video analysis, strength and conditioning, basically everything that was revolving around Manchester United, the club. He had time to sit down with Sir Alex himself. But we clicked, you know. Apart from that, we had some good social times together, and that's important, because then the formality falls away, and then you can really see what sort of human being you're dealing with. And I think in that respect, we are both sort of singing from the same hymn sheet, so to speak. We like a joke, we like a laugh, you know what I mean? And we both love football.
So how does this dynamic work within the Australian setup? I mean, is it a good cop, bad cop routine? Or do you take all the training? Does Arnie take all the training? Or are you, not a shoulder for him to cry on, but an extra ear to listen to? How does it all work?
Well, basically, Simon, all of that. You know, I've been a long time the assistant to Sir Alex Ferguson. So, and that role suits me really well. I have had, numerous manager's jobs as well, even before I came to United in the Middle East, and I had a few other ones. Football and clubland has changed a lot, so I understand the pressures that managers go through, which is really, really good. And on the other hand, I really know the role as an assistant really, really well. In terms of, it's all about providing the best possible service for the players to prepare them in the best possible way. And the only thing that's paramount is their performance, right? And you have to sort of fit each other in. You know, you need to know exactly, you know, where you have to step in or where you have to step out. And I think that just goes naturally between me and Arnie. It's like somebody summed it up, I think, after the first camp, and he said, how long have you guys been working together? He says, what do you mean? It looks like you've been working together for years. That was really our first camp. Mm. And that sums up, you know, a good relationship and a good partnership.
Right. It's still very early days, though, and we're building up to a very big tournament in the Asian Cup. A couple of games down, we're speaking, you know, on the eve of the clash against Lebanon. How are things tracking in your eyes as you build up to this big tournament in Australia's defence of their Asian Cup title?
I'm very happy with the fact that we've got this big tournament coming up. Although a lot of people will say, well, just after the World Cup and having a big one like this. But the fact that Arnie has just stepped in after the World Cup means that we have limited time, obviously, to get the players to prepare. That means that you have to maximise the time that you have with the players. And in that respect, because I know how players respond to the environments you create, but it's one of the things that I said the other day to the players. They have come a very long way in a short period of time because things are different. Yeah, we create a different environment. We want to play differently. Yeah, it's by far not as rigid, I would say, as it was in the past. We want a lot of flexibility. We emphasize a lot of ability for players to be creative and express themselves, but that takes time. Yeah, it's not like football or especially in any sport where you work with a group. It's a process. It's always a process, and it's not like a flick, you know, with a button. But every time they've come back, we've added a layer. Yeah, we explained what we want, very clear. The players have responded tremendously well because you can see that, you know, of analysing the games afterwards. And if you look back to the Korea game, for instance, where we set out a really clear plan, let's really make another statement like we did in Kuwait. We pressed them, we got them, we created a chance to score the goals. Can we do the same against such a good opposition as Korea? Then to do that and sustain it for 90 minutes requires one, high level of understanding, two, an unbelievable strong mental discipline to sustain it. The thing was, even though that goal came completely against a run of play, you know, from Korea, we managed to keep on going, still managed, you know, to create the chances. And the goal in that last second was the ultimate reward for the players. Basically, it was everybody pushed that ball over the line. But they deserve that. For me, the next step is to turning those chances we create, you know, in goals and converting goals. And like I said, we're going to have the ability in the future to have more than one, two, three players on the score sheets, for the shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, you mentioned just a short period of time that you've got to work on all these things ahead of the Asian Cup. There's been, as you rightly point out, a lot of change. Bert van Marwijk has gone, Graham Arnold and yourself have come in, Kenny Lowe as well, the retirement of Tim Cahill, Miller Jedinak. So a lot of things have changed in a short period of time. Is there enough time for Australia to be not only competitive at the Asian Cup, but also potentially go and retain the trophy?
Yes. I can tell you now what I've seen. That's why I said we've come a long way in a short period of time. We when we play that first game, we will be ready and we'll be more than ready. I mean, in terms of the way that the players have responded to the way we want to play, because it requires understanding, because it's a constant game of recognizing and making the right decisions. Now, to do that, we need to be very clear and concise in that short period in transferring that information. I can say Arnie is a top coach in that respect. He has very, very clearly an idea how he wants to play, and he's got a very great manner in getting that across. Then the next step is to take that on the training pitch, partly him, partly myself, to making sure we bring it alive. And then the last step is for the players to perform and execute it on the pitch. Then you've got the feedback analysis and say, listen, this is what we want, that's the training, there's the game, bang. And we are on the right track, for sure.
One of the issues Australian footballers face for a while now is trying to find a top-quality striker. We had Mark Viduka, Tim Cahill filled the void, even though that wasn't his natural position growing up, and he did it brilliantly, obviously. And now we're trying to find another one. And it's not easy, obviously. It's not like when you're at Manchester United, you can go sign Ruud van Nistelrooy or Louis Saha or Dimitar Berbatov. They've got to come from within the ranks. what have you made of our striking options and trying to find that direct avenue to goal? As much as you want the team to contribute, you still might need that player to contribute that moment of brilliance on an individual basis.
Yeah, but it's a waste of time to try to go and forcefully look for something that isn't there. I grew up in the 70s, best team that Holland ever produced, with Johan Cruyff. Mm. He was a striker. He wasn't a striker. He never played there. Played all over the pitch. That meant that other opportunities, it's all about getting into goal-scoring areas. That's the most important thing. If you've got one, don't get me wrong, if you've got a top striker, fantastic. Right? You would be stupid not to play him. If you haven't, you need to be creative. You need to make the most of it. I think we've got a variety of good qualities in our striker positions, which we need to use in different ways against different opposition. Like I said, we want to be very flexible in our approach, in our attacking approach. I don't think you will see us play going forward in an attacking sense and you see the same thing all the time. Yeah, you see a range of things, yeah, but there's variety and therefore it becomes a level of unpredictability. What we want to make sure is that we create the right chances, get into that goal-scoring opportunities, making sure people arrive there to put in the back of the net. Again, I think myself, that's what I've picked up whilst being here in Australia. I really do think Australia make too much and a big of a meal of it, which I have to be careful because it creates a collective sort of view to the also to the supporters and the viewers, which not necessarily is always helpful. For us, we're working on a process. We've just started. Everything is going well. For me, it's just a matter of time before we start finding the back of the net, and you will see different names on that goal sheet every time.
Ronnie, I'm interested, you sort of peppered this conversation with some key words like flexibility and variation, which I think in Australia, because we've had a lot of Dutch coaches, we tend to sort of pigeonhole and stereotype what the Dutch coach is all about. You, to me, and I mentioned this to you when we had a general chat a few weeks ago, you seem to me like an atypical Dutch coach in that perhaps because you've worked in different parts of the world, you've taken little bits of different footballing styles and philosophies and implemented them into your overall a coaching ability. Is that a fair comment that you're not, you know, the typical Dutch coach that has to play one specific way?
No, absolutely. I think myself that Holland over the years has produced some unbelievable, fantastic players that have all moved on to play for big clubs. You know, in the past of the likes of AC Milan and Barcelona and Manchester United and all be successful and win big trophies. That meant they always had a strong national team as well. Holland has always been, has an attitude of being on the front foot, try to dominate, try to, you know, play in a certain way, again, which is based on good possession and things like that. But at the same time, I think over time it's fallen into a little bit of a trap of being too rigid, too slow, too pedestrian. Mm. My sort of philosophy that I've built over the years and in terms of developing players and, you know, building successful teams ranges more of looking at the best teams out there and looking at the best players and try to extract why they are the best and try to come up with a formula, you know, to put that on the training pitch and then into the games, which is different from, you know, the sort of rigid approach that a lot of times was coming sort of from the FC. This is what it is and there's nothing else. And luckily I've been working at the highest level, which I know that the more flexibility that you can have in the game, the more likely you're going to be successful. Mm. And things move on, you know, in the world of football as well. So I've always made sure that I always keep an eye on, okay, what are the developments? What do the best players tell me? What do the best teams tell me? And you keep pace with that trend, you always hit the right notes in terms of the training pitch and the information you give to the players. Otherwise, you're falling behind.
Interesting. Just on the way the Socceroos attack, going back to that point, Arnie has made a key point since he took over of trying to get more support around the central striker, saying we're probably too reliant on Tim Cahill and, you know, we want to put more players around the number nine so it's not just about the striker to score. In saying that, against Korea, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like because they sat quite deep and the wingers played a bit narrow, it seemed very bunched up and Jamie McLaren couldn't even see the ball, never mind get a foot on it at times. Is that a problem when teams sit deep against Australia in this new formation, trying to find actually more space for the striker?
As they're liable to do, probably at the Asian Cup as well, at least in the group stage.
Yeah, well, obviously you played against a top top side in Korea, and I think they were a little bit probably thrown off the fact that, because they like to keep the ball and move the ball, and we obviously analyse them in different games, and they're very, very capable in moving and rotating ball. We never really let them, and Jamie McLaren, in that respect, did an outstanding job. Mm. If you summarise Jamie's type of striker that he is, he's a little bit like Suarez, you know, in and around, off the shoulder, coming in the little gaps. So it's vital for other players to recognise his position, to recognise his run, yeah, because it's a small little gap to sort of feed him in and to get there. Now, that is unfortunate because you look back at the games and there were certain moments where I thought Jamie picked up really good positions. The one that springs to my head, for instance, the ball that popped out in the second half, Massimo Luongo had a shot and Jamie was exactly what, but he couldn't just get it, you know, that little thing. If he would have taken it, boom, turn and put it in the back of the net. The thing of that is every game is different. The key, what we want and what we expect to achieve over those next, you know, months and games, and when we get into the Asia Cup, that we put the blueprint down for how we want to play, and we've got different type of strikers. It's good to have a variety of strikers. What I like, really appreciate, of the fact that we've got now in the Socceroos is that if you look at all our front people, we've got diversity. If we know we like to, for instance, hit the spaces in behind, right, we want pace. But if we haven't got that space in behind, we want clever movement. We've got that as well. If we want players to single out 1v1, to take players on, we've got that ability as well. That's, I think, one of the biggest strengths that we have now in comparison to previous teams.
Brilliant. Anything more on the Socceroos, Simon, before we move on to the other parts of Rene Mueller's
team? I think we've covered a fair old breadth there. I mean, we could probably go on for about 8 hours, but now let's talk about some other stuff in Rene's career.
I think people are fascinated about your career because, I mean, your time at arguably the biggest football club still in the world, even though they've dropped down a bit since Sir Alex's departure.
And second biggest in Manchester.
Simon's a very big city.
No.
I'm a big Liverpool fan, Renato. Surrounded by us right now.
This is going to be the hardest part.
But it was going to be hard for us because we have to indulge you now as a Manchester United fan for the next 10 minutes or former coach for the next 10 minutes or so. But what a journey, being at that football club under Sir Alex Ferguson. Can you give us an insight as you reflect on it now before we get into the specifics on just what that was like, being in that environment for so long and so successful?
It was unbelievable and arguably the best time that I've experienced as a football coach to be part of that thing. But the start of it is really funny in some ways because I was working in the Middle East at the time and I was managing a club at the time called Al Sadd, and a previous really legendary Scottish player, David Mackay, you might know him, obviously signed to play for Spurs and had a great game. He was the manager of the National Under 17 team and was my neighbour. And we spoke a lot about it at this time. At that time, he was back in the UK. And I met him for one of the courses and I said to David, I said, listen, I've met a few people of Manchester United. I don't know whether this is going to lead to, but at least, you know, if you hear something, then at least you know what's happening. So I was back in Qatar and David was that sort of guy that you never knew whether you could take him serious or not. So he rang me up and he says, hi, it's Dave McKay. Hi, Dave, how are you doing? He says, has Sir Alex Ferguson rang you? And I started laughing because I thought it's one of those Mickey take things. He says, no, but I've just hung up in Prince Charles. He says, no, I'm serious here. Has he rang you or not? I says, no, he hasn't. Oh, that's disappointing. He says, have you given him the right number? Because I know in Qatar they added, you know, a digit to, oh, right, that might be it. Anyway, 10 minutes later, ring Sir Alex Ferguson on the phone. So you think, Sir Alex Ferguson. Hi, Rennie, how you doing? So obviously, we got the conversation going. We made an arrangement then that I was coming out in January because there was a break. And that's when I first met him, you know, to go to Carrington to get introduced. And I was spent 5 days there. They had me doing different sessions with young kids, with kids that are about 14 and with the, you know, the under 18s. Spoke to many, many, many people, watched the first team train, had loads of conversation with Sir Alex himself, and that was basically the start of it, and say, listen, I'd love to have you on board, this is what we need. And I basically came in as a skills development coach. So I basically put in the whole technical program, so players like Jesse Lingard, Marco Rashford. So Jesse was 8 when I first met him. Rashford was just 5 and 6 when he just ran through the door. But all those guys have gone through that technical skill program, which was purely based on, you know, the ability to manipulate the ball in tight areas, and to create a better situation in any 1v1 situation. That was it. That was the remit. And it served us well.
Carry on.
Well, and obviously, I started, you know, to find my feet in there. And eventually, I started to do a little bit more work with first team players individually, with Forland, with Ruud van Nistelrooy, and more players started to sort of, you know, what I was doing, and, you know, they started to feel the benefits from it. And obviously, Sir Alex was you know, supported this development. Eventually, then I got the opportunity to coach the reserve team. So I moved sort of up. I did still the academy, but moved up, which was good for me, because that for me was a way to show them how all that important aspect of dominating that 1v1, how do you transfer that in a game setup? Eh? Because the game is 90% you move the ball nice and quick. It's 10% that the players have the ability to beat somebody that most likely makes the difference in the game, which is at the same time very exciting part for players to watch. So I had a team with Gerard Piquet, Johnny Evans, Jeb Rossi, Fraser Campbell, and we won the treble that year with some unbelievably exciting football. As a fact, we beat City 6-1 that season.
That must have been a long time ago.
it was great. And then you know, after that, obviously I've moved up in the first team role when Carlos Queiroz left. And well, it has history is such. But what I'm most proud of is, because when you look back, when you're in it, you just carry on season by season. When you look back, you actually realise you've been part of the most successful period in the history of Man United. Mm. And then the things that were there were built over years by Sir Alex Ferguson. You know, the big pillars like stability and continuity, that's where they drive upon. When they fall away, or they, you know, that's basically one of the reasons where United is now, because that's gone.
It must give you an awful lot of satisfaction when you look at players like you've just mentioned now, Jesse Lingard, Marcus Rashford, not only in the first team at Manchester United, but with the England national team as well, and doing well for the national team. That must give you an awful lot of pride. Yes. That you played a big part in their development.
Yes, the most important part is that I was always a very strong believer. That is one of the things why I stood different from, let's say, the Dutch FA coaches, because I believed strongly in the Curver method. I think you must have heard of here in Australia, because it's been here, but I've worked personally with Will Curver in that skills development program. And I always felt very, very strongly that, especially the way that football was heading, every footballer, no matter what position you're in, they need to have the ability to manipulate, you know, that 1v1 situation, whether they're put under pressure by an opponent or when you look for it. That's an outstanding quality that every successful teams have. That is one of the things that we want to introduce in this soccer route team as well. We need players that have that ability to take players on. Mm. We need, because that ability creates a level of unpredictability, which is very hard to defend.
Keen to get your assessment, considering your record with such young talents on Australian youth development, and we'll get onto that in a moment if we can, and also the A-League and what you make of that. But let's stick with the Man United theme for now, because we were privy, weren't we, not too long ago, to sit down with Rene in an off-the-record type meeting and have a chat when you first joined the ranks, and you told us a bit about Cristiano Ronaldo, arguably the greatest player of all time, certainly in the discussion. What was he like as a young kid coming through? For the people who haven't heard these stories, what made him into the phenomenon that he is today?
Total commitment. Total commitment. The boy came, he was 18 years of age. And at that time, I was sort of doing some individual stuff with Diego Forlan. First thing he did, can I join you? Yeah, no problem, but he did. Cristiano came in, he was that sort of young, you know, that young darling whore, you know what I mean? But he was a bag of tricks, as they say. But there was not enough effectiveness to it, so to speak. But more than anything, he knew exactly what he wanted. The moment he went, and basically, there was one day that I basically said, Cristiano, I know exactly what you want. So he looked at me, what do you mean? I says, I know exactly what you want. You want to be the best footballer in the world. He says, yeah, correct. He says, great, because people that have high ambitions are most likely more, you know, successful as well. Now, the first thing that you need is, have you got the attributes to do it? Yeah, I can be the best opera singer in the world, but if I have no voice, you can forget it, yeah? So that's one thing. The second thing then is find a strategy, because you're not going from here you are now, 18 years of age, to become the best player in the world. There is a process that needs to take place, and over time you need to achieve things. So have you got that in your head? So that was a sort of awareness process that I did with him, making him aware of certain things and then make him understand what he needed to do on and off the pitch to get there. I call that Ronaldo from good to great. You know, it made a thing of it in the program for him. We looked at it, so we worked a lot of things in that respect together. One of the outstanding times was that when he was suspended in the early parts of one season, I think he missed 3 or 4 games. So he didn't travel with the team, so he always stayed behind. And that was the time where I could really work with him individually. And we worked focusedly mainly on all the finishing. You know, there's a sort of, like I said, there is a clear process to do it, make him more aware about, because Cristiano always wanted to score the perfect goal, hit it in the top corner. But he needed to appreciate the fact that scoring, and especially being important for the team, has more to do with volume. Yeah, the more you score, the more chances, more likely you're going to win games for United, the more likely they're going to win trophies, and that is what you need to get behind your name. And that is exactly, obviously, what he's done in the 6 years that he was at United, and he carried it on ever since when he was at Real Madrid.
Amazing. What about Sir Alex? What was he like? We hear so much about the hairdryer and things like that when, on the very rare occasion that Manchester United was struggling. Have you got any sort of insight into those legendary moments?
And is there a bit of Fergie in you on the back of that?
Well, it depends how you look at it. Yeah, I think so. There's plenty of things. I mean, especially his sense of humour. People say, and what is he like, and what's the most outstanding thing? The first thing that I would always say is that the amount of laughs we shared together. There was not a day that we didn't laugh or have a joke together. And people refer to that hairdryer all the time. And was he? And some people say, well, was he a difficult man to work for? He was an absolute blessing. He was just fantastic. Superman management. You know, knew everybody within the club. You know. From the kit man to the washing ladies, to the chef, to all the players, to even the young players. He knew everybody by name. He had an enormous eye for detail in personal matters, you know, whether it was somebody's birthday or whatever, that sort of stuff. But overall, the most important thing, what sums it up, is just imagine the fact you work at the biggest club in the world that tries to achieve to winning the biggest things, Premier League, Champions League, whatever trophy is on show, you need to win it. That comes with pressure. Yeah. Then you've got the manager there, who's obviously had already a very successful amount of years before I joined, sort of in 2006-07 as the first team coach. But you want more, you want more, you want more, you want more. There's not been one day, not one day that I came to Carrington that I felt nervous or that I felt any negativity or negative pressure. Never. Just imagine that. And that all comes down to the man management skills of Sir Alex Ferguson, who was an absolute star in delegating and trusting people and making sure everything is right. Let's get on with it. And he made sure that he was overlooking everything and pulled things together when needed to be, and fantastic. Loved every minute of it.
Do you still speak on occasion to Sir Alex? Do you still ask his opinion on football matters, or is it not like that? You've sort of moved on from that?
No, I'm still in touch with him, yeah, regularly. I mean, I send him a text, and if he's there, you get a reaction back straight away. A lot of times it's basically, you know, exchanging some whatever funny comments, because, like I said, his sense of humour is fantastic. We obviously know that he's had a little bit of a health scare not that long ago. I went to see him for a coffee just before I flew out to Australia the day before. So I had about an hour and a half with him. He was in really good spirits, asking a lot of things about Australia and football and Graham. You remember, you know, Graham coming, you know, to the things, and I say, yeah, I remember him. I says, yeah, I had you spending some time with him, didn't you? Yes, he did. He nearly slept with me. you know, that was...
So, I'll have to edit that bit out.
I mean,
people will be driving off the road in Australia right now listening to that.
In my house, like that, that is. But no, it was good. It was good, and he was such a knowledgeable man. Very good listener. Really, really good listener, and the timing of his things to get things across, and yes, obviously people refer to the hairdryer moment, and there's only one thing that drives that, the desire to win at all cost, and if it took to do that, then obviously then he would step it up and go, but then after that it was gone. I move on.
Is there one hairdryer moment or one legendary spray that sticks out in the mind from Sir Alex that fired the team up?
Were you there when he threw the boot, allegedly threw the boot at Beckham?
No, he kicked it.
He kicked it?
He kicked it. It was a good kick, actually. It was a good kick, and David was in the way and just Just hit them over there. Yeah. To be fairly honest, in my time, I can't really recall. You know, I only know one precarious moment where we play West Ham at home and we got a player send off, and he was at his edge then to making sure that sending off was not going to impact the fact that we were, you know, losing the game and a chance of winning the title. So he sharpened everything up there, and you know, we won that game, and then a week later against Wigan we won the league. But that sort of thing, he was, and it, regardless who it was, I mean, look at experience you had in the dressing room, whether it was Scholes or Giggs and all that. It wasn't like he picked on whatever young players. It doesn't, regardless who it was, he would go, you know what I mean, straight at somebody and say, how old are you and how many games have you played, giving them all away like that, you know what I mean, that, you know, that sort of stuff. But
just on that, you're a great person to ask because you've worked through this generation, I guess. Someone like Sir Alex, I dare say, could say what he wants and players respond, but coaches often talk now about the change in generation and the highly paid Premier League stars and the empowerment of footballers, and that you can't give them the hairdryer anymore. You can't scream and shout anymore. You have to relate to them in a different way. Is that the case? Have you noticed that over the last 5 to 10 years in football?
Yeah, I definitely think things have changed. I mean, like when we grew up, we were different than our kids, and the environment and everything that goes with it. And you know, nowadays, you know, everything is there for everybody to share or to comment on, you know, in social media, which is, makes it very difficult for managers nowadays. I mean, you go back in the time that Sir Alex started, it was a very clear, you know, what happens in the dressing room stays in the dressing room. And there was this authority about, you know, with managers and coaches and all that. Yeah, things have changed, whether for better or for worse, I don't know. Players nowadays, they respond in different ways. At the end of the day, again, the performance and the results are paramount. But the time now to sort of give, let's look at Sir Alex coming to United. It was in 86. Took him 6 years before he got the train on the track and when it started, you know, rolling. Nowadays, that won't happen.
You get 6 minutes, never mind 6 years.
Exactly, tell me about it.
As you've said, a lot of experience, obviously, as both a head coach and as an assistant coach. You're number two here with Australia. Do you still have ambitions to be a number one, maybe back in Europe or elsewhere?
Not at the moment. Not at the moment. My sole focus is on this project. It's a long project, all the way up to the World Cup in 2022. That's 4 years. Listen, I've enjoyed every single minute of being. I think Arne has assembled an unbelievable staff. I recognise a lot of the same qualities and the same environment like we had at United, which I know how important it is. It's very important for the team because they are the sort of undercurrent, you know, that sort of forms the base for the players' performances in every aspect. That means that in that respect, Arne can sort of take a step back, relax a little bit more, to making sure that his focus stays on where it needs to be, because in clubland, you are there 24/7. With a national team, it's not like that. You don't have to be like that. You have to also trust the players for the fact that this is an elite environment. They are the best. Mm. Yeah, we pick the best. There's no finances involved. You're not going to spend 10 million to bring a good player in. No, we select the best one. We need to make sure that jigsaw fits, bring the best out of them. You know what I mean? So it's really good. So back to your question, Simon, I have no intent. At the moment, there was, since Arne rang me in January, I think there's been 5 or 6 other job opportunities in clubland that I could have taken, that you might have said that's maybe more interesting, not interesting, or financially more attractive. Didn't never played a role for me. For me, what excites me really is I strongly believe that we, with the Socceroos, not only we can be successful, we can create something that is different. You know, a different identity around the Socceroos on and off the pitch that people want to go, wow, that was exciting to watch. That's what some players, what do you want? Of course I want to be successful, I want to win things because I know what it feels like. It's fantastic. Mm. That's what you aim for. But what I really want is when my mates in years to come say, hey, listen, I saw Australia play. Oh, that was fantastic. Jesus. You know, the way that you guys went forward, the thrust, the way you pressed, the way you created the chances, the way the goals you scored, that's what I want. A
couple of quick ones to finish because you've got to get on and prepare our national team. But the standard of the A-League, what do you make of it?
after this game, I'm gonna stay in Australia, so I'm gonna see some games live, which is always good. I think you've got a better view than look. Obviously, I've seen a lot of it already on TV. I think the Australian A-League is improving year in, year out. You can see that. I think that, and that is not to blow smoke, but Arnie with Sydney has done such an extreme job, because I think in his way, how he sets up the team, the flexibility he creates through the rotations, not many other A-Leagues have sort of mastered that. Yeah, and it's very hard to defensively to react to that, because you always become reactive, and when you're reactive, you're always too late. So that is a very proactive, tactical way of how we've done it, and really interesting, and that's one of the reasons why he's so successful. The key is, I think, for Australia and the soccer for the future is to make sure that they get it right at grassroots level, to get that skill development program going, to create your own Jesse Lingards, Marcus Rashfords, the Messis and the Ronaldos, and they are here. The only thing you need to do is get the right program, make sure that the kids have got the right environment. A lot of things happening today, new vote, new board, everything comes in.
Yep.
I expect that that is going to be the people stick their heads together, and it's for the good of the game, because that is what drives everything. The stronger the A-League, the stronger the grassroots, the stronger the product, the stronger the national team. It all rolls in. If it segregates, you know, if it all tries to, I'm going to protect my own thing, it will be detrimental for the development of Australian soccer.
And just one more to finish. I believe you've remodeled the song Sweet Caroline into Sweet Socceroos.
I did.
Apparently.
I did.
Going back to your opera singing point before, maybe you can. Maybe you do have a future in that paper.
Really. Are you going to give us a rendition, Ronnie?
I did. I did. I will after we won the Asia Cup.
We're going to hold you to that. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, no problem. No problem.
Sweet Socceroos it is, with you on board, Rene. Yeah. It's great having you as part of the national team, and fascinating having you speak to us today. I think
brilliant. Thanks very
that.
Much, Rene.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, can't get on.
All the best against Lebanon. All the best at the Asian Cup.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
But wasn't that fascinating, Rene Nielsen? Absolutely brilliant. And I do apologise if there is some discrepancy between the audio. We're media people. We're not technologically savvy at all, so we apologise if there's any sort of discrepancy, but I dare say the quality of Rene Muhlenstein's comments made up for any of that, if
absolutely.
That was the case.
Absolutely. I think just to get some insights from a man who's obviously worked at such a high level, and you know, some of the stuff he was telling us there about his time with Manchester United and Sir Alex Ferguson in particular, that's absolute gold. Brilliant.
It was. And you can see what an asset he is to the national team, and how passionate he is about the national team already. This is not a job. Yeah. This is a project that he's invested in.
And we're gonna hold into that Sweet Socceroos tune once we retain the Asian Cup in January.
It was his initiation song, and he didn't want to get into too much detail, but we understand he was pretty impressive, acting as Neil Diamond, changing the words to Sweet Socceroo. Wonderful. We've got some questions we'll get to in a moment, but it's a tricky one for us to talk to the AGM that is in a few hours from now, the time we're recording the podcast. So the guys on the Wednesday pod, Murray Shaw, Andy Harper and Brenton Speed, will no doubt be able to sink their teeth into that huge issue in the game. But how are you feeling on a few hours away from the vote, and where do you think we're going to be positioned afterwards?
Well, hopefully we're going to get a board that is going to take this game forward, because, you know, let's be honest, the last 3 years have been difficult. There's been an awful lot of politics that have stagnated the game's growth. So it's time to, you know, stop all the talk once this board is elected, whether we agree with the makeup of the board or not, and get on with fixing this game and moving it forward. I have to say that, you know, the one thing that I'm concerned about, and hopefully we'll get the chance to ask these questions if there is a press conference afterwards, it is the process. There's been a lot of talk in the background that there's been political manoeuvrings and favour swapping, and, you know, you vote for this guy and I'll vote for that person, etc., etc. We don't know whether that's true or not, because obviously we're not involved in those conversations. But, you know, at the end of it all, we have to hope that we get a board that is going to be A, independent, and B, passionate and committed about, you know, restoring this game, not just to health, but taking it through the glass ceiling. You know, the Lowys did a fantastic job, and that's been often forgotten about in this row over the last 3 years.
Yep.
They did a brilliant job in taking the game from where it was to where it is today, but we've sort of stuck So we need to break through that glass ceiling and take it on to the next level. That's what I hope the board will do.
From the outside, it seems, I might be wrong, that the A-League clubs are the ones that are really controlling a lot of this. They started, I guess, the drama with the board, and it feels like they want to run everything in terms of the political manoeuvring. Do you think that's the way it's being done?
Well, certainly, look, that's the rumour. Again, it's difficult to know 100%, and I don't think it's just the clubs. You know, obviously, the state federations have 58% of the vote. So, you know, they're having a big say in what's going on.
But are the
well.
Clubs leaning on them?
I'm sure they are, and vice versa. Mm. I mean, to be honest, you know, we wanted a more representative and democratic, if that's the right word, process to actually get these things in place. We've got that now. Maybe a natural conclusion of that is this political horse trading. I hope that that's not the case, and I hope that the people that we end up with are not just going to represent stakeholder interests, that they're going to look after the whole of the game. But the crucial thing in all of this is to grow the financial pie. That's where football has struggled in Australia traditionally and in the modern day. We need to grow the revenues to a level where the whole of the game will be able to progress forward, not just the A-League, and I'm pretty sure we'll have an independent A-League at some stage. That's great, but also the national teams and the grassroots, you know, they all need to be in this together. We all need to work together. It's unity. That's the thing that we've struggled with. So I hope that this board can unite the different factions and grow the financial pie, and therefore the game can realise its potential. Look, I don't care if football's number one or number two in Australia. All I care about is that football realises its potential. And in all honesty, Garvey, I'm sure you agree with this, I think we've only just begun to scratch the surface as to where it can go.
Most certainly. But it's still come on in leaps and bounds in the last 15
Indeed it
years.
Has.
I mean, God, I remember a time when we used to clamour for a Socceroos game. We used to clamour for our best players to get together. It only happened every 4 years, it felt like. And we had a game on Saturday night in Australia, best team out there, 35,000. And it's become sort of commonplace for us. You can just step back a little bit and go, geez, how good is this? And that's come from reform, and yet we've got levels to go to, and hopefully the new board takes us to those levels. But we've come a long, long way as well.
Absolutely,
it's important to recognise that.
Garvey. And you know, the other thing, just in closing on this conversation, is a lot of people have been focused during this run-up to the election on the individual identities of people and who's going to lead the game. He's our leader, she's our leader. You know, we've got to get over this messiah complex. To be fair, we've had that for 15 years, no disrespect to the Lowys, but you know, we wanted this messiah to lead us out of the wilderness. Now Frank Lowy did that. It's not about that. It's about a good team being put together. It's not about the captain, it's about the team. And whether they can work together and unify the rest of the game to take us forward. So the identity, the individual character of the leader, it doesn't really matter. It's about the collective and us all working forward, going forward together.
Hard to discuss the intricacies because we don't know what's happened in terms of the vote, but all over Fox Sports News, no doubt you'll have analysis, and yeah, the Wednesday podcast, no doubt, will serve you well in that regard, so listen into that. Speaking of the leader moving forward, let's go straight to our questions. There were some brilliant ones on Twitter. Apologies we didn't ask some of them to Rene, but as I said, I was scared to touch my phone while we were recording in case something went wrong, so I left the questions till later. But this one from Joshua Watson is pertinent. Was Milligan a good choice for captain ahead of Sainsbury? I'll answer this one first. I'll be honest, I was in the Trent camp because I thought, you know, the next World Cup, you know, Millsy might not be there. He's 33 now. More likely than not, he won't be at the next World Cup. But I think when the appointment was made of Mark Milligan, initially I thought straight away, you know what? It's just about the now. You can't worry about what's going to happen in 4 years. Touch wood, God forbid, Trent Sainsbury has a bad injury run and he's not even there. You've just got to go with what is at your disposal now. That's the best option. I'm not saying Trent isn't, but Arnie feels as though it's Mark Milligan. So just put him in now and let's just try and win as much as we can straight away.
Look, I'm probably in a similar camp to you, Garvey, in that I think the long-term solution is Trent Sainsbury. But I think Arnie's actually played this very smartly because Millsy, in all honesty, will probably retire after the Asian Cup. I'm like you, I can't see that he'll make the next World Cup. So, you know, this is a good way not only for him to go out, but it's also a good interim appointment for the Socceroos because as we know, Trent is Arnie's son-in-law. He doesn't want the distraction of having to answer questions as to why have you chosen your son-in-law as captain ahead of an Asian Cup, which is only a couple of months away. This way, that question doesn't apply. And then once the Asian Cup is over, then a decision has got to be made about Mark Milligan. I'm pretty sure it'll be Trent Sainsbury going forward. But that's I think he's played it quite smartly.
From Craig, what is it that the Socceroos coaching staff see in Robbie Crews? And that's a question that we need to soften down a bit, because Robbie's been a great servant for the national team for a number of years. But he does seem like he's battling a bit now. I think Arnie's tried to rebuild his confidence, and I thought he was good against Kuwait. Maybe against South Korea, he struggled to really create. But it's a real test for him now, because you've got the Bill putting on pressure, Craig Goodwin putting on pressure, and he's at that time in his career where...
Not to mention Arzani.
When he comes back, yeah. Where he's battling to hold his place, isn't
he? I don't like these individual targets. It seems to be a bit of a thing for Australian
fans. He's become the boy. It
was the same with Brett Holman. It was the same going back many years ago for Mark Viduka, if you remember. Can we believe that? But, he used to get a lot of... he doesn't score enough goals for the Socceroos. But, you have to put this into context as to the overall performance. Not just about assists and goals. Of course they're important. Of course they are. And Crews is an attacking player, but he also offers, work defensively as well to cover Aziz Bajic on that left flank. He's a busy player, and he's an experienced player, so he does offer plenty for the Socceroos. Okay, he might not be everybody's favourite. We're all entitled to have players we like and don't like so much. But I think it's unfair to single out one specific player. Robbie Crews has been a good servant for the Socceroos, and I think he's still got plenty to offer.
From Karun Walker, in the last few years, our top talent has gone from the A-League to overseas, and they've gotten injured, which has hampered their development. How come they're prone to injury overseas but not in the A-League? That's not a bad question. I mean, it might just be, basically just the luck of the situation, yeah. But maybe it's the change of environment, the change of seasons, the length of the season that's maybe having a bit of an impact on our players. When they go abroad, it does get a little bit more intense, doesn't it? Sometimes in those long pre-seasons and things like that. I'm not sure if there's a direct answer.
I think you're right. I think it's multi-layered, the answer to this question. I think it's all of the things that you've mentioned. But also what I would say is that I think the competition for places means that the intensity is not just on game day. It's in training 5 days a week, 6 days a week, or whatever it is. You've got three, maybe four players who are after your spot. So in every single training session, I'm not suggesting for a minute that the A-League players don't train hard. But it's been pointed out to me by Marcus Babbel, for example. If you look at an A-League squad, 23 players, there's a limit on squad size. Five or six of those will be young players, three of which will be goalkeepers. So, if you're a player of 23, 24 years of age that's already become established in the A-League, your spot is not guaranteed, but you're more likely than not to play every week. I'm not saying that affects your intensity at training, but I think it does make a difference. When you've got three or four players breathing down your neck, you've got to put in that little bit extra at training. And maybe that workload, which A-League players, when they go to Europe, are not necessarily in the first instance accustomed to, maybe that takes its toll. But in all honesty, who knows? Yeah. It could just be bad luck or pure coincidence.
Well, Arzani's a case of bad luck, obviously, so you can't isolate that one. From Connor Dent McLean, apologies, Connor, for not asking this to Renee Muhlenstein, but I explained why we were a bit nervous too before go through my phone while we were recording. But he's asking about Matt Ryan and his ability to succeed in such a high-pressure environment, like a club such as Manchester United, for example.
Who he's been linked with, yeah.
Yeah. Geez, that save was special on Saturday night. Yep. I mean, that's as good as Matty's produced, and he's had some pearlers over the years. I guess the test for Matty, there's no doubt he's one of the informed keepers in the world right now, is how he goes under the pressure of a big, big club. There's the pressure of the Premier League and the national team, but then there's the pressure of the big club again, and how you adjust to that one. And that'll be the test as to whether he joins the absolute elite consistently, which I think we all agree he has the ability to do.
I have no doubt that Matty Ryan could not only play for Manchester United or a club of that size, but do well there. I think he's got everything in his locker, including, crucially, the mental side of the game. He is so strong. He's had to overcome adversity, let's not forget. When he played for Valencia, he lost his spot, he had injuries. Same when he started at Brighton, he didn't start too well, but he's recovered from that. He's got, to quote the old word, bounce back ability. And that's what you need. You need endurance. You look at Timmy Cahill's career, obviously we're going to celebrate against Lebanon. You know, he went over there as a teenager and did it tough. It wasn't easy for them, but you've got to be mentally strong to overcome those hard times. Matty's done that, and he's got every ability, as he's showing at the moment in the Premier League. I think he could easily play for Manchester United and become established as their number one. But of course, at the moment, De Gea is there, so it depends on him leaving.
He also had the World Cup in 2014, where he didn't perform as well as he would have liked. Yeah. We all went in with high hopes, and he's admitted that he played the games in his head before. So he's shown an ability to learn from his mistakes so well. He's got the confidence mixed with the humbleness, Matty, to admit, you know what, I wasn't great there, I can be better, and then improve. And he's still young as a keeper. He's got levels to go to.
And don't forget that whilst he's over there, he's also become, I don't know what you call it, friends, but he's taken on board the advice of Mark Schwarzer, who's based over there and I'm sure is always available for a chat, you know, given the Australian connection. And I think Schwarzer, having been there, done that, got the T-shirt, played for so many years at the top level, and, of course, won Premier League medals, even though he sat on the bench for most of his two seasons with Chelsea and Leicester. You know, he's a good ear to sort of talk to as well. So I think he could do it quite easily.
One to finish from Ninko Magic. This one's for you, Garby. If Perth Glory are premiers at the end of the season, will you grow a mullet inspired by the great Ryan Grant?
Well,
I don't think I'll do that. Maybe I'll grow a beer gut like the great John Markowski or something like that. He's a former Perth Glory champion.
I've done it for
not
you,
sure
Garvey.
About the mullet, because the beer gut's on its way already, so that's an easy thing to do. We'll wait and see, Ninko, but appreciate the sentiment, of course, of the Glory and how well they're travelling so far. And they should get another 3 points, you would think, on the weekend. Let's transition into a little preview of the weekend before we sign off. Yeah, against the Mariners at home. Big game to finish after a big blue on Sunday afternoon. Sydney against Victory, which would be special. So, yeah, there's already some, even a month in, we're nervous about a Mariners trip to Perth against the ladder leaders, and I guess the worry that they're going to get walloped.
Well, it is. You know, Mike Mulvey came into the new season with a revamped squad and a lot of optimism. I don't think anybody thought they were going to win the thing, but I think most people thought they were going to have a much improved season. They still may do. But they've got to start performing, because the last couple of weeks have not necessarily been that flash, certainly in terms of defending. So they've been beaten quite comfortably by both Adelaide and Victory, and this is just as tough a test for them, particularly with the long travel as well. So, you know, Perth are looking good. Top of the table. When was the last time Perth were top of the table?
I think towards the end of the 2014-15 season at some stage, but they haven't started this well since the NSL days. Yeah. The first month, I think 98-99, and they won it in 2001 or two, something like that. They haven't started the first month on top and been the pace setter. So, yeah, it's got the feeling of the old Glory days. As I said last week, though, get there to Perth Oval on Sunday and support this team, because they're doing the job for you. You know, we want the Glory days back. We want those big crowds, the old lockouts at Perth Oval. You know, they deserve it in a sense, because
good
they're doing a great
you,
job.
Good to see you wore your purple shirt
off
as
the
well.
Park. I have off done. Purple. I have done. That was completely by chance. Friday night, Western Sydney, Newcastle Jets. That's an interesting game. Wellington, Adelaide on Saturday afternoon in New Zealand. Brisbane Roar, Melbourne City. John Aloisi looking for his first win of the season. So that's a big game for him, of course. Then the big blue on Sunday afternoon. That should be a beauty. Sydney FC, Melbourne Victory. Just, you get the reminder straight away of that epic semi-final.
You do. And this is going to be at Kogarah, obviously. So, you know, an interesting new venue for this particular fixture. And, you know, hopefully the stands and the hills are full for this particular game. Always a great rivalry. Always very intense, this game. It's one of the fixtures. In fact, probably the fixture I look forward to most of all. The derbies are fantastic, but this game always has that little bit of extra something, just because they're the two teams that normally compete for honours at the end of the season. So it should be a great one.
Been a great podcast. There's the W League, of course, all those matches live on Fox Sports, the W League and the A League. And we didn't even get through the UEFA Nations League, because we got entrenched in that René Meulensteen chat.
Indeed.
which was wonderful.
England,
we hope you enjoyed
England
it.
In the semi-finals,
you're going along beautifully. Knocked off
Not
Croatia.
Not a bad year.
Bit of revenge. Bit of
exactly.
revenge. And the Netherlands, obviously, yeah, in spirit of René, bouncing back beautifully with a win over the world champions in France. So they're rebuilding nicely. But it's all about the Socceroos on the podcast today. René Meulensteen was fantastic. Thanks for listening. Tune into the boys on Wednesday. And, of course, all the football shows across the weekend on Fox Sports. Simon Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Garvey.